Sunday night. That means from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening, this is John McMullen, John Mack to some. Welcome to the 277th episode of the weekly John Mack Radio Show. The recording for the previous 276 shows may be found at www.johnmack13.com under the Radio Show tab. And John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-M-A-C, so that's www.johnmack13.com. In addition to the previous radio show, you'll also find links to my online daily newsletter at my web home. The newsletter is a curation of 10 news articles from around the country and the world. Try it and subscribe. Only one email per day, and it's free. The writers in the Hudson Valley should be aware that every Thursday evening is the weekly meeting of the Mahopac Writers Group, now in its 22nd year, at 6:30 p.m. in the Mahopac Library on Route 6 in Mahopac. More than 150 books have been published by writers from this group. Once a month, the same group also has a morning meeting on the third Wednesday of the month. So June's meeting will be Wednesday, June 19th at 10 a.m. at Coffee Time on Route 6 and in the Red Mill section of Mahopac. Finally, 2 days later, on June 21st, there'll be the monthly open mic at 7 p.m. at the wonderful Hudson Valley Writers Center in the Phillips E. Mount train station in Sleepy Hollow, New York. There are also two poetry workshops every month in the area, one on the second Wednesday of the month at 6:30 p.m. in the Mahopac Library, and the other on the fourth Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. in the John C. Hart Library in Sherbrooke, New York. The John C. Hart Library one is this current Wednesday, May 22nd. Anyone wishing more information on any of these meetings may contact me at johnmack13@gmail.com. That's johnmack13@gmail.com. There will be no shows for the next 2 weeks, first for Memorial Day holiday, then one for a previous speaking commitment. But I hope you'll be right back here at the same 7 p.m. Eastern Time 3 weeks from today. My guest will be writer, activist, ex-Peace Corps volunteer, and advocate for various affairs and veterans affairs and libraries, Priscilla Goldfarb. Now, to this week's show, as mentioned, the 277th in the series, my guest tonight is poet, composer, musician, and performer Hayden Wayne. I only met Hayden recently when I participated in an open mic in Beaton, New York, where Hayden was both the host and the featured artist. I was so impressed with his performance that night that I not only bought two of his books, but decided that he would be the perfect person to have on the show. Those to listen regularly, I remember he was supposed to be here 3 weeks ago, but due to a communication foul-up, he joins us tonight. The listeners wishing to join Hayden and me on the air may do so by calling 646-716-9756. That's 646-716-9756. I've generally held any call participation until near the end of my conversation with my guest. Let's get started. Welcome to the show, Hayden.
Well, thank you, John, and I have to tell you how tickled I am by you having your opening theme of Peter Gunn by the brilliant Henry Mancini. It was such a thrill to listen to that again. I mean, my God, that was his first hit, and look at all the stuff that he subsequently wrote and left us. Brilliant composer. Thank you. That was great.
Okay. Would you start us up with the poem?
Certainly. This is my most recent piece. It's self-explanatory. No one is allowed to touch in spite of all the yearning, needing love so very much, and Notre Dame is burning. Suicide, the latest fad. Complete society's gone mad. Too caught up to know how sad things to first get really bad. And science is no longer in, theology our origin, and our youth on heroin, the sky has truly fallen. And Nero plays with no concerns, the art of the deal and what it earns, how much is enough and all it turns, and Notre Dame is burning. The arbiter of truth, the news, sold out to make a buck. Selling advertising space, they just don't give a. And we all know the lies they sell, but nothing can be done. They know their power, untouchable, and hurt us for the fun. Drowning from political thugs, no conversation safe from bugs. Loneliness, the heart it tugs, and Notre Dame is burning. Where is the moral outrage and the taking to the streets? It's just bootlicking selfiedom and one-upsmanship through tweets. This orange menace turning red, impending conflagration, this selfish decadence unleashed will undermine each nation. Too dumb to know the reason why, too arrogant for learning, and more each day we die, and Notre Dame is burning. And shouts of let it burn by those so well protected, and all the rest of us in turn are not at all respected. And all the children put in cages, and all the workers stagnant wages, and no one listens to the sages of the coming war and how it rages. Dispose this rank and file who are sycophantly vested, while hinterland screams, "Sieg Heil!" and our constitution tested. An indifference disconcerting, through apathy perverting, a dictatorship is flirting with shouts of let it burn. Oh, Notre Dame, my Notre Dame, our Notre Dame, sweet Notre Dame. The forest, tree-sized timbers that held the copper roof is now all burnt to embers, and the world aloof.
That's very powerful and very black, and I hope that we rewrite the ship. I hope that we get something done anyhow. So
I feel that the power of the word is the ultimate demonstration of democracy, and it has really come to pass that we must take it upon ourselves to do everything in our power to right the ship of state.
Yeah, well, thank you very much.
And if I may, and if I just may quickly say to everyone listening, what I find most unifying amongst all of us is the hatred of politics. So the next time you get into a discussion with someone and they start ranting in your face or showing some belligerence, just turn to them and just benignly say, "Why are you being so political? What's the solution? Blah, 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 blah. What's the solution?" And if they continue, just walk away because they obviously have none. We have to find solutions. There's no longer time for being as erudite as hell, talking about everything that is wrong. And the irony of all that is by the end of the day, all we're doing is adding weight to the negative because that's what we're specifically conscious of. We have to be conscious of the solutions. I firmly believe the world is the way the world is because we have consciously made it that way. If you do not like it, then change the way you think.
And the way that you talk about it. I generally start off by asking guests where they grew up, they went to early school, but you were, long before you went to school, you were a bit of a musical prodigy. Please take us through your early childhood years up through the King and I.
Okay. My father and mother were showbiz people. My mother was an Earl Carroll vanity girl. Through these portals walked the most beautiful women of the world. She was eye candy, but she was absolutely as brilliant as she was beautiful. And my father was a human anthology in music that you literally could not request anything from the International Songbook. So I guess prenatally, somehow, all those forces were in play. I was born in 1949, And by the time I was 4 years old, my father started teaching me piano. By the time I was five, he put me in the orchestra pit of a show he was conducting, King and I, and I was playing tenor drum. And there's a strange dichotomy because it's like, yes, my father, no, that's the conductor. Somehow I had that dichotomy, and I obviously had good time. By the time I was 15, I won a second place medal in the New York State competitions for piano solo. I had first gone to, I was born in the Bronx. I was raised in Flushing, went to PS 166, and my mother became extremely alarmed at the lack of quality of homework I was bringing home. And my parents, being the tenacious people they were, went window shopping one day and, luckily for them, found a foreclosure in Great Neck that they could manage to buy a mortgage for. And I subsequently got one of the most miraculous educations that one could possibly get in a public environment, which really is my foundation for subsequent life. I went to conservatories of music and then ultimately became protégés of various individual outstanding musicians. And then it's just the diligence of exploration of all the masters. I firmly believe there are only two things that have to be taught to any person. One are the tools, how to learn, and the second, the desire to. And if you have that and you have some spark of self-esteem that is going to give you that ego, not the vanity, the ego, to drive yourself forward relentlessly against all the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, which inevitably are going to be there, you would not only will succeed in demonstrating a plethora of documented proofs of your meditations, you're never going to be bored, and you're going to find that this becomes the microcosm of your life, which, I beg your pardon, which started as the microcosm of your life, will become the macrocosm of your life. And that becomes a complete game changer because the whole view of the world now, let's be analogous, so somebody's playing Game Boy or something like that. Well, your vision quest becomes your game. And the whole world becomes this integration of how you can expand and uplift the platform and keep raising the platform, greater complexity. And you just keep going and expanding and hopefully meeting like-minded souls in the context of meaning how driven they are. Not that they agree with you, but then you can have a synergy with these people and these intercourses that become educational just by the sheer proximity of another individual and experiencing them demonstrate their vision quest, their proofs of their meditations. It's very exciting. I'm very blessed.
Now, after them picking up your education, did you go to a standard high school, or did they continue to high school?
No, that was, I went to, I was in Baker Hill School, it was elementary school, and I left the class of 42 and landed up in a class of 19, which they thought was large. I failed all the tests, and Mrs. Carroll, God bless her, kept me after school and started bringing me up to snuff, and then I was flying. And my Great Neck North junior and senior high school experiences were extraordinary. In my particular, Andy Kaufman and I were in the same graduating class. Johnny Avnet and I were in the same class. He was the director of Fried Green Tomatoes and Risky Business. Francis Ford Coppola had graduated 11 years before. He was an alumnus. It was a very interesting public school. We had new books every year. It was literally like going to private school, but it had all the great alternatives because it was a public education. And it was very exciting that way. And then, of course, the timing of my life, being born in 1949, rock and roll was born into me. My father was an absolute human anthology of the International Songbook, as I said before, so all of that washed through. And then when he ultimately saw my determination in wanting to be a musician, he demanded me being a literate, educated one. So that brought in the whole classical end. So I am this complete morph of all different disciplines, which have given me such a unique voice and such an advantage, in my opinion, of being able to cross-dress in any discipline. And it affects my writing accordingly, because all the great masters evolved out of the, quote-unquote, the folk music of the time. This is why I go back to square one, and you and I had this conversation the first night we met about the importance of the power of the word. I say to everyone out there who's listening to this, please, please, please do not be insecure and undermine yourself. Write everything down. By the end of the year, you've already risen a curve of excellence that is now going to afford you an amazing luxury to edit what you've done in the previous year. And you're going to go, oh, that stinks. Oh, ooh, that's kind of interesting. Let me grab that. Oh, that's a good piece. And da-da-da. And it's going to continue for the rest of your life, and you're only going to refine your skills. You're going to only get better and better dexterity. You're going to find yourself, as a result of the proofs, the documented proofs of your meditations, finding yourself, if you're willing, to go out and read in public with other people, which develops other skills. And then you put yourself, as John Yoon very well know, the master class of being graced within the presence of the poet reading their own work. And that's extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary. And that's what I'm trying to proliferate.
Well, and to mention reading your own work, how about one more poem?
Okay. All right, National Arts Club, which I'm a member of the literary group down there, we have these annual gauntlets where we all have to write something, and one of them was Turning a New Leaf, so I wrote this. Turning a new leaf as a haberdasher for Adam and Eve, perhaps a fig leaf, depending on the size of the fruit. At least you don't have to worry about an inseam. Somebody's got to listen. If you don't know how to think, soon enough you will not. So, should I take it from a book or a tree or maybe a table? Ah, there's the rub. So many choices. Maybe it will spring as spring does, surprise me with the change of life's renewal, helping forget the death that has numbed for far too long. And as I feel the ardor start to rush again within my veins, the fragrance of your being will fill me with rapture, so many scented flowers to capture as I hold you in my arms. For once upon, time stood still, as perfection does, but you have awakened what can no longer remain perfect. Static no more, it moves. And you and I, with this now endless tide, are constantly turning, perpetually reborn, as seasons change, as does this tree bear fruit, not once, but forever. Time is only time because of change, whether perfect within a singular nano moment or the endless continuum of striving for perfection, which is inevitably always just out of reach within the space of choice. This consciousness, this plucking of the fruit from paradise has set us into motion. The leaves turn, covering something new, exposing something else that has always been, but nonetheless, always the more. So, shall I cover the beauty of your perfection with the shame of my ignorance? Or shall the voluptuous innocence of our nakedness please our sensuality to explore endlessly all that is possible? Timeless is as timeless does, the turning of leaves, of death and renewal, of things to pass and things to come, of you and I, of us as one, as leaves that turn and turn and turn and turn.
Now, will there be an anthology published of those?
Of those at the National Arts Club?
Yes.
No, there was nothing mentioned, but that particular poem is in Dog is My Co-Pilot.
Which I have right in front of me. So,
yeah.
Yes. And what happened after high school, since you had all this musical background? And
I went to a conservatory. While I was in high school, I auditioned and got into a conservatory and they were of music, which I will not mention their name, which was very uplifting and very exciting. And when I applied, being insecure at my audition, I came in, I presented myself as a theory major, and they said, no, 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 you're coming in as a composition major and a piano minor. But then insidious things began to happen. All of a sudden, I was not allowed to continue with my piano teacher, who was teaching in their prep division. And then all these very sick, egocentric, jealousy games. And it got to be so toxic for so many of us who were professionals. I mean, there was Yusef Lateef, and there was Tom Bridwell. Tom Bridwell was playing piano for the Temptations. There was Art Tripp, who ultimately became the drummer with Frank Zappa. There were Good Rats, myself. I was in the Salvation Navy at the time. And it just became unbearable. And I left, and my father was very upset. And then he went, and he found me remarkable people. Larry Wilcox for orchestration, who taught me how to listen. Very important. It sounds like an understatement, but how to listen. And Tony Alesson Sanford Gold, whose jazz class was really a keyboard harmony class because of all the potential patterns of substitutions, whether they're the minor three patterns or the flat five patterns, flat two patterns. And this extraordinary, jazz is quite fascinating in the respect that Tony would say to me, he says, all right, boy. He says, you know the melody, play the harmony. And that's always a chuckle to me because harmony is such a strong impetus for me in my work. I've written over 400 works now, 10 symphonies, a cycle of 10 string quartets, there's operas, there's all this stuff. And the harmony is so evocative because it trebuchets you into these other suspended forms of animation to beguile people as you tonally tell a story, as you tonally do your poetry. And then what ultimately happened is in the refinement of my language, I found myself being so swept up by the alliteration and the onomatopoetics of words, musically speaking. The musicality of language really moves me. So that became a thing, and it just totally evolved and evolved and evolved. And I work, just so people understand completely, I'm working a minimum of 15 hours a day. And I work in my sleep. I believe in sleep consciousness as much as I believe in wake consciousness. As a matter of fact, my sixth symphony, which is a choral symphony called The Gift, a great deal of it came out of it conceptually, out of my dream state, that I would wake up in the middle of the night and run to my desk and start scribing down before I forgot. And it was extraordinary. That was another lesson. That was another evolution in my consciousness. And things keep changing, and my consciousness keeps changing. And let me just excuse my motor mouth here, but let me say something for the listenership, which is very important. You keep refining yourself as you go, and you keep expanding your horizons. Let me do a metaphor. Somebody in a radio interview in Chicago asked me a very interesting question. Well, how do you explain composing? Now, that's a tough question, especially anthropologically. And I thought for a second. I'm on air, so I try to make my thought as quickly as possible, and I came up with this. Imagine a bucket of sand, and the object is to figure out the chronological order of the grains in the bucket. And while you're getting down to the bottom of the bucket, mind you, it's getting more and more complex. But the most complex thing is imagining the bucket of sand in the first place. Now, as esoteric as that obviously is, believe me, it's spot on true. So when any of us sits and gets an idea, you write it down. whether it's one word or a vowel, or you're playing with words, you're doodling with words, whatever you're doing, and in the process, get out of your way. I firmly, anthropologically believe the truest definition of craft is the ability to get out of your own way. And if you allow yourself open, conscious, very Zen conscious, you open yourself up to all receptibility, you're going to be astounded at what drops into your lap. And then the exponential curve, because of the perpetual learning curve of the process of doing relentlessly, how you get more and more adept at all the processes within the process. And I trust me, you will all get better if you put the time in. I don't care what you do in life, no matter how you write it down, no matter how however you ultimately decide to choose what your vision quest in which you wish to fulfill is. You're inevitably. I'm sorry.
I get it on the sleep certainly. Back in the day, years ago, when I was a computer programmer, I would wake up in the middle of the night and I would be able to see on the screen, not on the screen, on the ceiling, a block diagram of a problem I was working on.
I'd be able to
tweak it so the next day when I got into the office, I was really transcribing to what I'd already done on my ceiling in the middle of the night.
Absolutely so. But let me throw this in. It's very important. I'm very impressed with your mind, because for you to have retained that, sometimes you will come out of a dream state, and we all have. So we have to all of a sudden we wake up because we have to do some ablution in the bathroom, and we try to get back to where we left off in the dream, and we can't. It's happened to all of us. I have found that if you keep some kind of tablet on the side, whether it's you write it down, not only are you now doing a different departmentalization in the brain through a neuroplastic process, you have now remembered where you came from, so you now can not only jump back and reconnect with that dream state, as it were, but now you have two portals of entry, because you've cross-departmentalized to do a linear thing of writing it down. You have the relaxation that you know you're not going to forget it because you've written it down, and you're off to the races again. And then again, if you get wow, get up, write it down again. And you may find yourself being up all night going back in semi-consciousness, semi-dream state, and by the end of the day, when you finally ultimately wake up with the satisfaction and the smile on your face because you've written all this stuff down, then comes the big editing thing. You go like, oh, was that good, or was I just, you know, pulling my own chain? But 9 out of 10 times, you're going to go, wow, there's something here, and I can fix this. And you went in, and there you were. You pro-created and created at the same time.
You might also have a hand recorder where you can pick it in. You can throw some
Absolutely.
Lines in. You can play them back later, so to
yeah,
know.
Anything to trigger, anything to animate the memory and trigger it. I don't care how you ultimately document it, but the documenting
right.
process will save your ass, period.
Right. And from composition, you moved into touring with some rock bands. How'd you get into that?
Well, okay. So as I said, rock and roll was born into me, and there were the high school bands, and there was this and that. My first professional band was the Dead End Kids when I was 17. And imagine, there I was in Clay Cole's world on Long Island, playing opposite the Shangri-Las. And I was just brand new 17 years old. I mean, what a heady experience. And then subsequently, there were other bands. I mean, the next notable band, getting out of high school, I was a band called the Salvation Navy. My God, who we played with, we shared the bill with. With the Hassles, with Billy Joel. I remember Billy was such a charming fellow. He would do his Walter Brennan impressions. And I remember there was one song he did that he had composed back then called West Hampton, and he took the organ solo with his nose. Funny, funny guy. But we were on the same bill with the Yardbirds, with Jimmy Page the year before Led Zeppelin, John Mayo, the Chamber Brothers, the Illusions, the Belvederes, Baby Huey and the Babysitters. Later I was in different bands like Man, where we were with Richie Havens and Sly and the Family Stone. It goes on and on and on. Fifth Dimension, Gordon Lightfoot. Then I was in the glam rock band Joe Bryath, and there we were with Gladys Knight and the Pips, and then once again with Richie Havens. Richie and I, our lives crossed paths for 40 years. What a sweetheart! We and I were very good friends, and professionally truly respected each other. I remember him by the very end, towards the end of his life. I had just had a world premiere for the third anniversary of the Holocaust of Interfaith Council of Holocaust Remembrance, and it was done at St. John the Divine, and my premiere was in front of 4,000 people. And the very next year, Michelle Akizian did something for the Armenians, and she had written something for Richie to sing, and there were 6,000 people, and there I am, Richie, we're talking about the work. Our lives constantly crisscrossed. It was just like prodigal sons in each other's lives. It was absolutely wonderful. And I was blessed that way. And then ultimately, tired of the duress of touring because it's exhausting. I primarily went behind the scenes, as it were, and started becoming a composer, because that's something that my father, not that I hadn't written some things before, but not on the level that I ultimately dedicated myself. And I was hearing my father's voice in my ear. He said, well, if you're going to be a musician, you've got to be a composer. You've got to be a composer. And so here I am back off the tour, the end of the tour, which was like the end of September of 74. And here it is now, March 75. And I'm going, man, you know, I'm supposed to be a composer. What am I doing? And I fascistically set a discipline for myself to write a song a week. And miraculously, by the end of December, starting in March, I had written 65 songs. So I got cocky, and I said, all right, let's write 2 songs a week. And that next year, I wrote 100 songs. So in 20 months, I wrote 165 songs. And some are better than others. Some are quite wonderful. But what was most important, which is only going to recap certain things I've said to the listening audience, by the process of me perpetually doing what I was doing and mastering song form, I was able then to get into longer and more complex forms, which you will unequivocally not be able to sustain if you can't hold someone's attention just within song form. So now you start expanding and you recognize the syntax potential and the potentials of form, whether you wish to adhere to them or discard them. And it all becomes part of this catharsis. And the next thing I know, I'm writing symphonic stuff, and here comes the first symphony, and then here comes this, and here comes that, and on for the rest of my life.
A couple of things come to mind. There's a fellow that I'm in a poetry workshop with who was a Russian studies major at Cornell just because he was interested in Russian poetry. And
right.
Then he became at Cornell. He got involved with, they were capturing photos for NASA, and they're doing work with them. And he wound up in photography and in magazines and that. And then he decided, I guess about 3 years ago, that he had to get back to poetry. And how was he going to do it? He was going to write a poem every day for a year. And at
Good
the end
him.
Of the year, he published 366 poems in 366 days, and he was off and running. Taking you back one step to the touring, were you playing piano? Were you writing?
Keyboards.
With the band?
I was Hammond B3. Clavinet D6, which is a Hohner instrument. Remember Superstition that Stevie Wonder played? That's that instrument that you hear at the beginning. That was a clavinet D6. And I had
okay.
one of the early Moogs. When I was at the I was in the electronic lab of Columbia University with Mario Davidovsky way by, my God, what year was that? 1968, I think it was. And you saw the beginnings of thing and sound synthesis, as well as another aspect of sound synthesis was not to have necessarily an industrial, already prefab soft synthesis, but to create your own sound and then sculpt your own musicscapes. So that was an eye-opener as well. And it was fascinating to be educated to look at serial composition and all of that, which didn't speak to me because I felt that serial was not freeing at all. You were demanded to use 12 tones before you moved across the bar line. And I felt the fact that you were taking the randomness out of the synchronicity, the serendipitous potential of the creative mind was counterintuitive. Now there'll be academics who will say, well, whatever. But I my mom used to yell in my ear, "Shut up, boy! Don't talk about your work. Play your work." When she really said, "Play your art. Don't talk about your art. Play your art." And I wholeheartedly embraced that. Your work has got to speak for you. If you are nervous about presenting your ideas, about presenting yourself, what greater glory than through the disciplines of poetry or music or painting or whatever, dancing, whatever, to present the true ego of yourself. And I mean that in the best of circumstances. I don't mean that in the vanity sense. You need to wipe your ass. You need an ego. If you self-perpetuate your own victimization, guess what? You're going to remain a victim. I'm talking about having desire and self-esteem to love yourself and say, "I know I can do this. It's hard. Oh, God, what's the word? What am I doing? All these people, I was so moved by what that person wrote. I wish I could. Well, sit down and try. Write about the salt shaker. Write about taking a shower. Write about cooking a meal. Write about a good relationship, a bad relationship. Write about anything but write." And in the process of doing every day, it becomes this mantra. It becomes this prayer. It becomes this sattvic calm. You have to be able to still yourself enough to hear the noise. It becomes this freeing agent of ultimately, as the Buddhists talk about and high spiritualists talk about, the dropping of the ego, the dropping of the mind to allow the universe in, the totality of totality. And rest assured, in the totality of totality, everything exists. So you wish to be as frictionless and as sticky as you possibly can, and get out of your own way. Even if chronologically it doesn't seem correct, write it down. Be a scribe. Write it down. Okay, the dust is settled. You take a breath. Now you go back and you say, okay, let's look at this thing. And now comes structural revision. Oh, are the typos here? Or maybe, not in the literal sense, typo, maybe wrong chosen words. Oh, I don't like that repetition. Oh, I wish I had that repetition. You know what I mean? Da-da-da. Okay, ba-ba, ba-ba. Back and forth, you do these battles within yourself, and you refine, and you refine, and you finally come up with a draft. You go, hey, and you move on. And then you come back and you look at it. Now, that said, let me throw you a curveball. And I swear to God, to all of you, this is absolutely true, and it's happened so many times in my life. I know how to get out of my own way. But there were times I fought it every iota. Oh, man, this is a sousy. Oh, God. And if it weren't for fascistic discipline, son of a bitch, you're going to write this. And you get, and you're going crazy, and you finally finish it, and you're totally unrequited. You throw it in the drawer. You need therapy. You're so messed up. You're totally drained because you got no blowback from satisfaction. Somehow time goes, you heal. All right, you're doing other things happen in your life. Make a long story short, some maybe a year later, you're looking for something, or you're deciding to clean the house a different way or rearrange something, and you stumble upon the piece that you haven't seen in over a year, and you start to read the piece, and you go, oh, my God, this is amazing. And you fought it every letter, every syllable, every note of the way. I can only assume that's divine intervention. And subsequently, after doing that a couple of times, I just go, shut up, keep going. You know, and just keep going. Just be the scribe. Just be the scribe. Be the oracle. Just keep writing it down. Trust me on this, gang. Trust me on this. Just get out of your own way and just keep writing it down. Don't throw anything out. Have a specific bin, which is your collection bin of all ideas. And then, of course, you have your notebooks or whatever you have, your folders of the stuff that you considered finalized that may get revised a line here or tweaked here. That's part of the game. And you have two separate things. And then you go back into the box and you look at ideas. And you go, oh, wow, you know something? I know what to do with that now. And that might be 15 years later. You can't explain it, but just get out of your own way.
One of my poems compares writing poetry to a perfect jump shot in basketball, where it goes up. If it goes in, it's perfect. Well, a poem is never perfect. We're always constantly editing and editing it. Sometimes, though, we have to get it out the door, and it goes out the door, you know. And if we hung on to it too long, we'd be editing it and editing it, editing it.
Before you answer the next question, let me just respond to that. And I really want to know how you feel about your poetry in this context. I find in the editing, what is really driving me is the tightness, to get the extraneous air out of it, and that the specific choice of words, whether you're in rhyming scheme or through verse, that the words become either alliterated or whatever. There's a very specific choice of words, and that becomes my editing. So it's about a tightness thing, to say what you're trying to say in as few words as possible.
My writing is never, or maybe once or twice, the rhyming, and it's also a dealing with words and ideas very often with a hopefully a catch ending, and I think I'm finished with it, and I give it to my wife, and she says, I don't understand this, and what are you doing here, and what are you doing there, and she gives it back to me, and hopefully we only do that once, and then I send it off someplace, and if they send it back, then I look at it again, and it's just because
it's a process.
I'm trying to get some ideas that are in my head right at that moment out the door. And when it comes back, then I still want to get them out the door. So I'm.
May I make a suggestion? Not assuming that you don't do this, but I throw this out for the listenership. Is whatever the idea is, write it down as brutally cumbersome and unpoetic as it might ultimately seem from a standpoint of rhythm or whatever ultimately will be dictated within the entire tome eventually. And you have the ideas. And then slowly you have to paraphrase the ideas to finally bring it up to which you subjectively feel is the standard you wish to raise it to. Let me cite you one example of that. I have an opera, Dracula Opera Erotica, The Unwillingness to Leave Our Dreams. It has nothing to do with Bram Stoker. It's just the name. It's about sexual subliminal behavior and unwillingness to leave our dreams. I have this aria to specifically write for Jonathan. There's only three characters. And it took me 2 weeks to write this thing, and it was brutal. And I finally got it to where I really patted myself on the back. And, damn, that's really good. I tried to set it to music. It was a pig, a drop-dead pig. I had to paraphrase what I thought so highly of. Now, with the consciousness of the singability of it in the music, to sculpt it into what it ultimately came. And it's a wonderful aria. But look at that. Here I am going, I really did it. Discipline, 2 weeks hard work. I threw a lot of things out. I sculpted it. There it is. It's right there. And it wasn't.
Yeah, that obviously happens. Two things about words. Before you moved away from rock
Even though I went into classical and symphonic writing and all that, I never left rock and roll. It's a folk idiom that is in me, die in the wool, especially rhythm and blues.
Absolutely. I go back before you. I go back to the Wrens and to Nappy Brown and to
Yes.
Yeah, but were you writing words and music then, or was it only music?
I'm going to share something with you all that's going to shock the hell out of you. When I was young, I didn't like to read at all. At all. And the only reason that I started writing words, which happened somewhere, I guess around 1970 or so, because I wrote The Circus. I conceived The Circus in April of 72, and I was writing my own text then. But it was like 68, 69, I started to make the explorations, because I couldn't find anybody who worked as hard as I did. And I found myself waiting for them, becoming so bloody frustrated, I said, this is ridiculous. So I started to write my own, and I wrote a lot of crap. But it was, and things subsequently, that I found pieces of music that, wow, that's really good, but let me rewrite the words. And I did rewrite the words later on, things like that. But that's what started it, the need to get off the dime. And thank God that happened.
Well, with all that's been going on in your musical career, what got you into poetry?
It was a way to still be, let's use the analogy. Imagine you have a car that has a very hot engine in it, where you can redline at 7,000 RPMs, all right? A racehorse. Well, I'm a racehorse, but I'm not always writing music, per se, but my creative juices are always locked at 7,000 RPMs. So when I'm not working on one thing, I change disciplines and I pull the component out, the verb of my consciousness and my processes, and I plug it in somewhere else. If I had to paint your house, I assure you I would be painting your house with the same laser focus as I would be writing a piece of poetry or composing a piece of music. It's focus. And the irony about focus is that when you're so laser focused, you can then subsequently partition the neuroplasticity of your brain. Here I am painting, and all of a sudden a lyric comes into my head because I have distracted myself from what's next, and I'm doing a mantra, I'm painting, and all of a sudden the words flow out. I can't begin to tell you how many times I'm working on Project A, and here comes a whole stanza of two for Project B or Project C that I wasn't even aware of that I was going to first start writing. Just get out of your way, write it down, so it's documented, you've got it for later use. That's the whole process. But what specifically happened was then ultimately moving up here and then finding other entities, which I was totally naive about, and wanting to be part of it, I found a way to be part of it was through the power of the word. So I started reading lyrics or specifically writing poetry. And as a result of that, practice. I kept writing. And now, for instance, where I have an in perpetuity contract with the Howland Cultural Center for second Friday nights at 7 o'clock, we do our poetry group, as you very well know. It's videoed for YouTube. There's over 500 videos so far. And I close the evening performing at the piano and singing some songs. So in other words, I'm doing a musical presentation of poetry beyond whatever poetry I had recited that evening. That's me specifically. But anybody who comes is welcome to sit at the piano or bring whatever instrument they want and do it that way. That's the way I have the house. Everyone is welcome. I want to hear your interpretation of your.
Now, is the schedule posted any place for the Friday nights that you will be at Howland?
Well, I know that Howland, the Howland posts it, but it's every second Friday at 7 o'clock. It's in stone.
Okay.
Without exception.
Okay. But that would be 12. I thought you said 7.
No, 7 o'clock.
No,
Friday at 7 o'clock. Always second Fridays of the month.
Every month.
Second Friday at 7 o'clock.
Okay, I'll put that on the schedule I send out to people.
Well, thank you.
You've won a whole bunch of awards for your composition, and it's been played all over the world in Czechoslovakia and Prague, and you mentioned in the note to me that a recording of what was read in Prague wound up on Bill Clinton's Air Force One playlist.
That was the Fourth Symphony Funk.
How much time do you spend with music, and how much time with poetry, or does it vary, just what strikes you at the moment?
It's a very valid question. And strangely enough, not to sound like a cop-out, there's a duality. It's constant, but it's whatever strikes me. You know, for instance, that first poem I read, as we all were so moved by the burning of Notre Dame, I composed that April 26th, and looking at its structure, specifically because of the rhyming scheme, which is unusual for me, I kept thinking, God, there's got to be music for this. So then May 11th, I set it to music. So there's that, and, you know, I'm constantly looking at different fronts and different ways to express myself, and it's a continual process. My biggest thing right now is educating people to be aware of their diet so they stay healthy, and that we really, this is grow-up time now. This is it. It's coming. This is the defining moment for an intellectual exercise called America, that created something, the most incongruous of men, who obviously created something that is so unique in its utopian dynamic that they themselves in their own history seem incongruous to what the Constitution demonstrates and the legal precedent of taking ephemeral idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and turning it into a law. But if America is ultimately allowed... She's seriously ill, if not terminal, right now. If she is allowed to die by the corporate United States forces, who is the specific terrorist to its well-being, lights are going to go out on the world. And I say to all of you, not on my watch. I will do everything in my power to raise the voice through our constitutional right of free expression, that we the people are the government, not the people we elect. We are the government. Yes, we have people run our mission, but you have to stay on top of the game. Democracy is a messy, messy business and a very difficult one, and we've forgotten because we got very complacent after a horrific depression and then another horrific war, and somehow found ourselves in this Aquarian age with the Beatles as our soundtrack. Quite extraordinary. And
I just finished something called The Arsenal of Democracy, and the point that I make, and I won't bother reading it, the point that I make is that World War II, there were brave guys on both sides. The big difference was that the United States outproduced all the other countries in the world. We had more bombs and everything. And then the leading person in most people's memory from World War II, Dwight Eisenhower, on his way out, warned us against the military and industrial complex.
Absolutely,
now,
because what happened was the
arsenal of democracy has turned into make us the arms dealer to the world.
Because what happened was with the invention of the atomic bomb, and I agree with the dropping of the bomb because they were talking about a million casualties. And, yeah, it's a horrific weapon, and I hate war, but when you talk about 80,000 dead, 90,000 dead because of one bomb, what's the difference between that and the firebombing of Tokyo, which killed over 100,000 people? They're all disgusting, and we should not be at war. But be that as it may, the atomic bomb represented a finality to war, and the military-industrial complex then ultimately realized, oops. So ever since the Second World War, we have protracted engagements without conclusion to the horrific statistic that 143,000 Americans have died in undeclared wars since World War II. Absolutely disgusting. And if you don't think the military-industrial complex, the dark state, doesn't have a specific greed agenda, when you look at the casualties in Vietnam alone, of the 58,271, where 33,000 were 20 years and younger to make profits, and we killed 6 million people in Indochina, it's pretty horrific. And the wars keep going, and they just keep going, and they just keep going.
It's
we have to stop
funny
this.
Statistics, because another related poem that I have is World War II Baby, and I talk about not only the undeclared wars and World War II, but all the other things that you never heard of, like 47 people dying in the Dominican Republic, 266 in
Absolutely.
Beirut. And the point that I make at the end is that since 1775, we have lost 1,354,000 people, of which 507,989 were in my lifetime. So more than a third of the United States citizens who got killed in the military died in my lifetime. And
you realize, I think my number is right, but it's something like only 30 or 40 years we have not been actively at war in our entire creation. That's a pretty demonic statement about the formation of a nation, of we the people.
Yeah.
So if we the people do not like this, then we the people have to take it upon ourselves and stop it from happening. And let me say something else, because I don't want to get political, but I've got to say this. To all of you out there who have your own filter, realize there's a truth in physics. Nothing is really 100%. So if you and I are polar opposites and we agree on 3%, why don't we at least get the 3% done and then sit down passionately, whether over food or whatever, and continue in our dialogue to see what now in this new equation of 100% is not 100% that we can agree on again. Not we necessarily compromise, but that we agree on and move on and keep moving the dial that by the end of the day we realize we have more commonality than we have tribal differences. Somehow we have gone off the rails, and one thing that really aided and abetted it was tech toys. The hearth has been broken because of the selfiedom of having a cell phone. And you hear me speak, but I have these discussions with my son, who's very intelligent. He's going for his master's. He's 4.0 in Lehman, going for his master's in history. And yet I have to say, son, put the damn phone down. It's almost as if it's Pavlovian. And what is very scary is that they're discovering in the neurosciences that those who are truly addicted to the endorphin rush of likes and are absolutely buried in the phone, they're losing 10 points of their IQ every year. It's very scary. It is an addiction. I'm an analog thinker because of my age. My digital integration maximizes the exponential potential because I never lost my analog. But the subsequent generations who became solely digital, they really have to learn the best they can from tribal elders like ourselves how to think analog, because thinking is everything, and it's what's going to separate us from AI. AI will eventually be able to do how many trillions of calculations in a nanosecond. But what about the randomness of humanism? That will never be able to be replicated. They can try to come close to it, but all of a sudden we change our mind. Why? What happened? And one size does not fit all, and we're all different as much as we are the same. The only thing that really unites us is that we are earthlings, and we now have to take it upon ourselves to save ourselves from the hubris of our own arrogant self-destruction, which does not have to happen whatsoever. We have to take a page out of the indigenous playbook. This moment is sacred for the next seven generations.
There's a terrific book from Gutenberg to Zuckerberg, and it's talking about how that when we hit the printing press, that the brain actually changed because we used to take our information in orally and from other people, and then reading became visual and solitary. And
the neuroscientist Leonard Schlein talked about that in The Alphabet Versus the Goddess.
Yeah, that's the same
book I recommend.
Happen now with going to the internet and everything, where we skip all over and people aren't able or aren't interested in reading long magazine articles or in reading novels or books because they aren't used to reading serially.
You said the key word, not used to. Very, very, very anthropologically astute of you. Well, how about my hubris? I'm a long-form artist in a text and tweet world. That's actually an opening line in a poem of mine, where I can't read it now because I don't know where it is. But the point. No, I know where it is. It's in the street between wormholes. But nonetheless, how's that for hubris? We're not talking 30 seconds. We're not talking 1 minute. I have pieces that are 30, 40 minutes, an hour long. I have theater pieces that are 2 hours long.
What's the difference, back to your writing, how different is the writing process between poetry and musical composition?
Well, I guess it's the same in the respect of looking for the right word, looking for the right note. But where it's different, I mean, it's apples and rice, even though we're talking about food, as it were. You know, I'll be sitting writing a piece of composition, and I'm looking at the through-line thrust, how I'm ultimately springboarded forward through something figuratively or motivically. Then, you know, if you're dealing with form, I mean, I like to embrace sonata form, even though I don't adhere to the harmony-specific restrictions as when it was invented. I like the roadmap to know that, okay, I'm sitting down, I'm writing something. All right, I've come to a cadence. So I determined that, okay, that's my exposition. Now, like a mobile, you know, like a colder mobile with balances of different size things depending on where the fulcrum is, the exposition is going to spring me into the antecedent, whatever the antecedent is. And then there's like development and then recapitulations and post-development and all this. I just use that as an expediting shorthand to give me a sense of the roadmap I'm in. But within the process of first exploring the exposition, which is ultimately through balance, you're going to define where I'm going next. It's this meditation of finding the key components that build the superstructure and thus the balance of what ultimately happens. You know, this Notre Dame piece, Notre Dame, Notre Dame, and it's, I was devastated, but then at the same time, I'm looking at all this political correct crap and all this phobia stuff, and now all of a sudden we're not allowed to touch each other. I'm not talking about in a debauchery way that we just can't communicate. It's like we are being so forced into automatonism that we're becoming more robotic than AI. And if we're going to be forced to lose our humanism and become AI without being competitive whatsoever on a level of AI's cognitive ability to come up through binary code with the answers of conclusions of postulates, we're going to exterminate ourselves because of evolution. We're not going to be necessary. So there has to be an acknowledgement of humanism, not the abuse of power, not using another person's generation or their sexuality or their religion or their financial class as a form of barter of manipulation. Hell no. As a matter of fact, I think one of the most helpful things that could happen to our society would be to take a page out of the Roosevelt playbook, this conservation corps, and have mandatory conscription. Everybody, nobody can get out, whether you have a disability, no matter what your work class, no matter what your, boom, you have to give 2 years service. Not to go to war, but to be part of a conservation corps that in the process of doing service, you're getting your associate's degree, which is 60 points, and you're also cohabitating all different likes, with L-I-K-E-S, of people to the point that you dispel the walls and you dispel the boundary and you go, wow, you know, that person was cool. I can rely on that person. And that's what will happen.
Well, I've already had that experience back when we had mandatory military service, and I was in for 6 months. And it was boring, it was chicken shit, it was annoying. However, I got to meet people of all different education levels, the country, all different religions. I was in Oklahoma, one of the worst places in the world. And it was just that everything seemed annoying until you look back and if you said, I really got a lot out of that.
Yeah,
you know?
And my offset of the toxicity of your words, of the annoyance, is at least you give a payment. The payment is there's education and associates. So there's an acknowledgement that you have done this. So this puts you towards a path of either going through like the Rhodes Scholarship type of phenomena of being academically worthy, or then going into the trade industry where we then look at infrastructure and completely reconstruct infrastructure for the 23rd century, which creates a whole different educational epoch. And teaching people new skills, it's a win-win-win-win thing, stuff that we desperately need, and then people become tangibly integrated with the infrastructure. I personally believe in the context of capitalism, there needs to be certain governance. And that governance is this, that as inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, there should be guaranteed the best education one can possibly get at no cost, the best health care that one can possibly get at no cost, and a guarantee of ever-evolving and growing infrastructure. Up and beyond that, let capitalism make as much profits as you possibly can. And let me tell you something. I personally believe this. I've seen this. A knowledgeable consumer is a buying consumer. A discernible one, yes, but a buying one. It's going to force the manufacturers to make better products. It's going to force the manufacturers to deal with a knowledgeable public that's looking for specific things to buy. And that's a great way to develop a whole new capitalistic epoch, not to siphon $27 trillion into the dark state of a military-industrial complex where we're now still in the 19th century. I mean, you talk about atomic power, you go, atomic power. Atomic power is nothing more than steam power. It's a 19th century technology. It's just a determinant of a kind of fuel. I mean, we have zero-point gravity now, so people are talking about from the other side of where all this money has been siphoned into, which is a complete different society from those of us on Earth. It's got to stop.
Well, you should be writing about it.
I am.
In addition to your poetry and your musical composition work, I know that you must spend time in promotion and marketing. I've seen your impressive collection of books and DVDs for sale. Two questions on this. Where can listeners find these items, and how do you allocate your time to both create and pay the rent?
It's a complete integration. You can find my works. My name is Hayden Wayne, HaydenWayne. There's HaydenWayne.com. If you wish to reach me, HaydenWayne@Hotmail.com. I told Facebook to go screw themselves. If I'm going to have a conversation with you, why does everybody else have to hear the conversation? Unless I elect to know these people, and they know me, and we decide to CC each other, or BCC each other. The whole point is, I'm looking for the intercourse. I want to hear the lilt of your voice on the phone. I want to sit across from you and see how your eyes make contact with me. I want to smell you. I want to see your passion. I want to see how passionate you are by your physicality, how you believe in what you're saying. And the openness to have the intercourse of discussion, even if we're at opposites, to allow each other to converse, because at the end of the day, we're both going to learn from each other. Even if we are polar opposites, we are going to anthropologically learn from each other. As far as finding my stuff, YouTube, there's a plethora of stuff with my name on it. You put my name in, you can find it, you know, whether it's Cirque de la Lune or the Howland Cultural Center, just Hayden Wayne. And I'm constantly throwing stuff up there as far as the books. Amazon, you can find a ton of stuff on Amazon, whether it's the CDs or the books. It's a process. And it's a form of madness, because I'm just constantly going. And sometimes I find myself remiss, not bringing my site up to date, or I didn't bring this up to date, and I'm running because I'm doing that. Oh, I got to write this, or not that I got to. I'm just writing it because that's the next thing that pops into my consciousness. It's a perpetual stream of consciousness. I am constantly lit.
And what's next for you?
I beg your pardon?
What's next for you?
Well, right now there's the discussion to put a show together. It's like a takeoff of Jacques Brel is alive and well in Paris. Hayden Wayne is alive and well in New York, and do a whole evening of disparate elements of my compositions in performance, slowly putting that together. I know that there's a request to do Cirque de la Lune yet again, which could be the fourth performance, maybe fourth and fifth performance at the Howland Cultural Center. There is preliminary talks of doing a concert reading of the opera, of the Dracula opera Radaka, The Unwillingness to Leave Our Dreams, which is for three singers. But what I have is I have electronic realizations of the 100-piece orchestra, so it would be done to that. So it's quite an earful, even though it's not the full, you know, production value of that. And more poetry, of course. And I know another symphony is in the wings. I ultimately get to that. And right now, looking at the horrors of the potential expense of putting a MIDI studio, which will give me the total dexterity, just what I needed, another hat to wear, right? I'm ready to jump out a basement window and hit the sky as it is, to have the immediate dexterity to do air quality masters and throw them up for people. Because I'm that prolific, it's the waiting time is killing me in between, just to throw it up and throw it up and throw it up and throw it up. It's time we have the Renaissance that's been languishing in the wings. We have to set the tone, as Dylan set the tone in the 60s and the Beatles set the tone in the 60s after the devastating rape of our psyches by the assassination of Kennedy, which was the destruction of innocence. Those of us who understand that statement still embody innocence. The subsequent generations have been denied of that. And it's a very interesting phenomenon because, in my opinion, one can only have youth with innocence and wonder. And without innocence and wonder, there is no youth. So those of us who still retain it are the youngest on the planet. And as a moral responsibility, as tribal elders now, we have to do everything in our possible arsenal to demonstrate to subsequent generations innocence and wonder, analog capabilities within our own neuroplastic abilities to thus be maximized, yes, in the digital domain. It's a great dexterity, but to have that, to become human and to be so human that AI cannot question that. As we are progressing right now, we are denying our humanism, the one single specific that separates us from AI. If we are to compete with AI and any other facsimile, any other iota of existence, we cannot compete. It's our humanism that sets us apart from AI. And we have to recognize that within unbounded consciousness, there is this multidimensional folding within our consciousness of everything that is possible within the totality of totality. We just have to open ourselves up to this potential and raise ourselves out of our present third density into the fourth density. The total consciousness of the cosmos is a light love, love light. And that may raise some eyebrows from some listeners out there, but think of it. Why would creation, by its own word, by its own definition, be negative? It seems incongruous, doesn't it? The only thing that happens negative from the totality of totality, within the totality of totality, where everything is possible, are the distortions of that truth. We of a varied subjective or what other reason consciousness distort the perfection of light, love, love, light. We are all of astral dust. We are all of our primordial beginnings. Wherever we are within an event horizon and can't see beyond where there may be infinite other event horizons other than maybe through a wormhole. There's something quite fascinating in physics, that the universe is accelerating at such a point since the initial Big Bang 13.8 billion years ago that now it's moving at a rate that may ultimately be faster than the speed of light, which means that the outermost galaxies will never be seen by us. They're at least 16 billion light years away. And they'll ultimately get to a point that they'll be on, what I guess, what which you could then shift by saying, beyond the event horizon. So that would mean if we wish to experience them, we're either going to have to go into a different dimension, which is probably through a wormhole, whatever that means in the literal, figurative, or metaphorical sense. But it still comes down at the end of the day with all these physicists, with these headache-causing equations, with the most astounding mathematics, where each letter of the equation, it represents pages and pages and pages of a theorem that some other genius created, and that's their shorthand to move the dial even further. I firmly believe at the end of the day they're going to prove that this is nothing more than consciousness. And like a hologram, where you can see a whole complete 360 of an image, you drop it, oh my gosh, and it falls into thousands of shards. If you pick up one of the shards, miraculously you see all of that total image as you saw of the holograph when it was in total. I think, in a metaphorical sense, that's what's going on with us. We are the shards of the total cosmos. And how we ultimately treat our pods, which we reside in, will determine the length we live, and how we ultimately prove ourselves conscious of the spirit within us will allow what inclusion of the totality of totality, as opposed to being just one monochromatic shard, as opposed to being a shard that happens to be just a shard of the total picture. And that total picture is yet still in us, even though our pods represent a shard, a specific, unique genus of the biosphere. I'm telling you, people, we have to change the way we think.
But we've corrupted it so many. We won't get all that done.
Yes, we have. People have corrupted it. But I say to you all, don't allow yourselves to be corrupted.
We've covered a good deal of.
If you have to eat beans and rice for the rest of your life, do it healthfully. Do it with light of heart. Look at the people around you. If you, you know what poverty is? Not being able to love.
That's a good line. We've covered a good deal of ground tonight. What else would you like the audience to know about Hayden Wayne?
You don't have to worry about me. I'm exploring every day. I'm uploading. I'm up to 8,000 pages a year reading. This is up and beyond the reading of all my work and proofing. Right now, I'm looking into physics. I'm looking at some type of correlation with numbers and physics and the speed of sound and the speed of light. And the fascinating thing with numbers that 9 is an amazing equation in the context of math that's almost analogous to what one would call dark energy. It's not dark energy, it's just that non-reflective light, but it's this non-massless, and yet there's always something in vacuums that's around mass and the clumping within this dark energy that seems to be our universe. And 9 seems to be this too, because everything in math seems to ultimately be divisible by 9 or affected by 9, certainly within the divisions of 3 and 6. It's extraordinary. If you add up 1 through 9, it adds up to 36, which equals 9. If you add 9 to any digit, you always revert. So 9 is 36, but at the same time 9 is 0, because 9 and 2 is 11. And 11 is 2. So you're back to 9 becomes invisible, and there's the number you're adding 9 to. It's scary. And I'm now right, what I'm looking at is that, is there a correlation with that and within the context of synergy within something within the context of our cosmos? I know that the speed of light is a particular speed within a vacuum. But in a non-vacuum circumstance, the speed of light slows down. Sound slows down as well, depending on the density. If it's in air, it's one particular speed. If it's in water, it's another. If it's through a diamond or hard steel, it's something else. It's quite fascinating. And I'm trying to see if, in fact, there is an equation that is, a symmetry. If there's a universal default here. I don't know, it's some people, have a yo-yo, some people skateboard, some people watch talk shows. This is what I do. I'm constantly exploring.
Well, that's good. We should all be constantly exploring. Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Absolutely, John. Thank you, and thank you, Hudson Valley. God bless you. You have no idea how special you are. Without the seeming politics and chest beating of a major metropolis, don't let anybody diss you. You are a powerful group. Be proud of what you do, and let everybody know what you do from a skill set, because keep the skills and the work in the community. Don't go to the nationals. Keep it in the community. Keep the money in the community. So that's where it really goes, and demonstrate to the disparate reality of this nation. One thing is our strength is our disparateness. It's also our Achilles heel. If a politician, even with the best altruistic intent, tries to appease every constituent in the country, at best, this individual is going to remain at the 50-yard line. You've got to go to the community where it's small enough that it's incestuous enough that you can have a conversation and demonstrate what can be done by the skill sets of the community and grow from that by example. We can fix this. We just have to be aware of changing the game plan. That's all.
Amen. Send in comments or questions to me about the show to johnmack13@gmail.com, and be sure to join us in 3 weeks at the same time with my discussion with Priscilla Goldfarb, writer and a terrific person. Go to my website, www.johnmack13, for the URLs of previous shows. My books are available at Amazon. Now, in the words of Mets radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put us in the book. And until next time, as he's saying, the old neighborhood, see ya. And we'll go off with the Eagles. Amazon, play Peaceful Easy Feeling.
Here's Peaceful Easy Feeling from your library on Amazon Music.
That's what we all want, peaceful, easy feeling.
Yeah, good for you, John. Good for you. I like the intercourse very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And thank you for the opportunity. I'd love to do it again.
And good night, Hayden, and good night, everybody.
Good night.